I'm Matthew Smith, Vermont Edition producer, and I wanted to let you know that the podcast you're about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity. Thanks for listening and enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Next Tuesday, it's primary election day in Vermont, and voters will select major party candidates for statewide, legislative, and county offices. Today on Vermont Edition, we have our third debate of the primary season. The three candidates seeking the Democratic U.S. House nomination with us are incumbent Peter Welch. He was first elected in 2006. He is seeking his seventh term in office. Dan Frylich, who is a doctor, a captain in the Navy, and a staff physician at the VA Medical Center in White River Junction. And Ben Mitchell, an educator who leads Impact Academy in Keene, New Hampshire. It's described as an innovative education model for at-risk high school students. Welcome to the program. It's great to have you here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's just go through the format that we'll be using today and throughout the campaign 2018 debates. In the first segment, I'll ask common questions of all the candidates. In the second segment, the candidates will have an opportunity to ask each other questions with a brief follow-up question if you want. Then we'll turn to a series of questions that have been submitted by listeners. If we have time, we'll have a lightning round of questions with very brief answers. And we'll conclude our program today with a one-minute closing statement from each candidate. So let's start off and talk about immigration policies. What would be the key elements of a comprehensive immigration reform bill that you could support? And could you accept the allocation of some money for a wall on the Mexican border as part of a compromise on the overall package? Dan Frylich?
No. To answer your question about a wall, I would not agree to any compromise spending money on a wall. That is ridiculous. What we should be doing is trying to figure out what we can do to address the core underlying causes of the undocumented immigration to America. And that would be helping the Central American countries to the best of our ability that are having difficulty economically and with their own security and with drug cartels, et cetera. So if one was going to spend about $40 billion or so, as Trump proposes, on a wall, one could spend much less on working on issues to help with nation building that would cost much less. Obviously, we need to continue with getting DACA into law. We need DAPA into law. We need to get rid of prisons that are paid for or that are corporate prisons that are making money off the current system. We should not allow whatsoever any kind of family separation. And Trump and his people need to be held accountable.
So if you could get most of what you wanted in an immigration reform bill, and being in Congress is accepting compromises. You get some of what you want. You don't get things that you don't want. Under no circumstances would you accept money for the wall?
You know, when you ask that kind of question, it gets a little bit difficult. My overwhelming desire is not going to accept any money for the wall. I mean, if we were able to get the huge strategic issues such as a path to citizenship for the 11 million undocumented Americans here, and we could get the big, big issues, we could put a 2-foot wall. But on a substantial level, absolutely not.
Ben Mitchell, let's talk about immigration reform. And could you accept some money for part of a wall?
Well, first, thank you, Bob, and thank you, Peter, and thank you, Dan. I'm really grateful to be part of this discussion. It's a remarkable opportunity. As a Democratic Socialist, I feel that most of the significant challenges that face the United States will never be solved through free market capitalism, because free market capitalism is at the heart of so many of the challenges we face. Having said that, my father was an immigrant from Ireland. He came here. He went to Dartmouth. He became an architect. He served in the legislature. He provided a lot of really good things. I think that immigration brings a lot more benefit to the country than we've been able to talk about recently. Furthermore, I think that if you look at the global refugee crisis that's affecting the entire, all of the industrial or whatever imperialist countries right now are trying to protect themselves, our unprovoked invasion of Iraq was one of the first dominoes that destabilize that region. And we need to recognize our culpability. I guess that's all my time.
And what about if you could get most of what you wanted in an immigration reform package, could you accept some money for the wall?
The wall is a terrible idea. It's a stupid idea. It's a red herring. It's designed to amp up his base. He's fueling immigrant fear. He's using it as a way to create xenophobia, to divide us as a country. It's part of a larger program that's going on to divide us against each other. It's a disinformation campaign, and I think it's obscene. I think as a truly great country would be talking about the international refugee crisis, and we would be taking a leadership role in how we can help this global problem that we all face together. Building a wall is like holding all of our toys up in our little house and saying, "No, nobody can have them." You know, shame on us as a country that we're even having the debate framed in this way. Shame on us. We're not a great country. If we're not we need asylum. We need worker programs. We need – and if a family comes seeking asylum to our shores, they should not have their children taken from them. Anyway, that's my time.
Peter Welch, what about immigration reform? That's something you've been working on, possibly some money for the wall. Your thoughts on this subject?
Well, number one, we need immigration reform, and it has to be comprehensive and it has to be bipartisan. The Senate passed a comprehensive bipartisan bill several years ago, and I would support that. And it had the elements of border security. In some places, that did include a physical barrier. Now, President Trump is just using this wall, and he's going to build it higher. He's going to make Mexico pay for it. And he's the biggest problem with getting immigration reform because he doesn't want a solution. He basically wants a problem. And he doubled down on that when he did this appalling thing of taking children from their parents, doing that in our name, in the name of the United States government. And as I went down to the border, and I was appalled at what I saw, the suffering that was inflicted by President Trump for political reasons. But what we would do would be have border security. We'd have a path to citizenship for the people who are here. We would definitely give legal status to the children who were brought here and are completely innocent. And my view, we should increase immigration. We need help having America renew its workforce and being America again. Thank you.
Do you think if that Senate bill came to the floor of the House that it would pass?
I do. The only reason we haven't had a vote on it is because Paul Ryan won't allow it. And in fact, I, along with members of the Hispanic caucus, had proposed to have what's called a Queen of the Hill option, where everybody's bill, from the most extreme Trump-oriented build the wall bill to the more bipartisan bill that I just described, everybody'd have a chance to vote on their bill. Ryan wouldn't let us do it. Trump opposed it. But that wall proposal of Trump would go down in flames.
Let's go to the question number two, which has to do with transportation. In many parts of the country, including Vermont, the transportation system is in terrible shape. Roads and bridges are desperately in need of repair. Now, the federal gas tax is 18.4 cents a gallon, hasn't been raised in over 25 years. It's not indexed for inflation, which has grown roughly 70% since 1993. Would you support a massive transportation infrastructure package that included an increase in the federal gas tax? Ben Mitchell?
Well, yeah, absolutely. I'm a socialist, so I support public investment and public ownership. You know, we haven't had a lot of investment in transportation since that great socialist Eisenhower was in office. The idea of public investment has been under attack for the past 100 years. If you look at the Constitution of the United States, right in the first section, it says to levy taxes to provide for the general welfare and defense. And we don't seem to have any problem spending money on defense. But when it comes to actually supporting the general welfare, that idea has been under attack from the right wing and not even from the center for a long time. And the bar keeps getting moved further to the left, that the idea of even fixing our roads has become something that we have to debate and that we have to fight for. This is obscene. It's absurd. So, yes, I would support a lot more public investment, but also public ownership. When we buy something like a road, we own that as people. When we throw money into a corporation that, you know, some corporate public-private partnership, we're just throwing it down the rat hole. So, yes, I would advocate much more public investment as well as public ownership.
So what about the concerns that raising the federal gas tax will hurt working Vermonters who travel a lot every day?
Right. Well, gas tax is a fairly regressive tax. So I think there's some merit to that. I do think that we need to have progressive taxation based on income and based on ability to afford that. But that has not been the trend. The trend has been constantly cutting taxes. You know, the Democrats come in and cut spending, and then the Republicans come in and cut taxes. And it's been the 1-2 sucker punch that's been going on for generations now. We need people to fight for this idea of the public good and public investment and public ownership. So in terms of specifically using gas tax, you know, given the way they inflate gas prices, it probably wouldn't be felt as much as someone might be predicting. I mean, we already have pretty high gas prices, so a slightly higher gas. However, I think that there's more progressive ways to pay for things, especially through public investment and public ownership. You know, what about public energy? Why don't we have more investment in publicly owned energy resources such as solar? We rely so much on fossil fuels because they've been funding the campaigns and making the laws. And my time is up.
Peter Welch, your thoughts about a transportation infrastructure bill and using the federal gas tax as a way to pay for it?
Well, potholes don't fix themselves. You've got to pay for it. And I think Vermonters get that. So as part of a comprehensive approach for a big infrastructure program, which we absolutely need, would be good for the economy, good for jobs, I would support an increase in the federal gas tax dedicated to transportation. But an infrastructure plan should be comprehensive. It should be roads and bridges. It should be public transit. It should also be broadband build-out. And it would take about $40 billion to wire all of rural America. And that has been a priority of mine, and it's actually an existential challenge for rural parts of Vermont and for rural America. So I am absolutely in favor of a strong, robust, and funded infrastructure program. The gas tax has got to be part of it, but also we have to recognize that in transportation, it's a user fee. Let's hope we get many more electric vehicles on the road. They've got to pay their fair share as well.
And how would you do that?
That's what's under discussion now, but number one, there would be a gas tax. With electric vehicles, one of the ideas is a mileage traveled tax. It's based on how much you drive and how much you use the highways. But the concept of user fees as a significant component of our revenue to pay for repairs and expansion and improvement has been with us since Henry Clay.
Dan Frylich, your thoughts about transportation spending and a federal gas tax increase?
Yeah, obviously we need a lot more spending on infrastructure, but it has to be part of a comprehensive approach to transformative change to address climate change with massive investment in renewables and mass transit. The problem is that one can say that and it will cost a lot of money. The question is where the money comes from. And I think if one is going to be honest and advocate for any of these kind of policies, one has to advocate for raising taxes on somebody because the revenue has to come from somewhere. So I think that wealth and income inequality is a dramatic and unsustainable problem in America, and we need to raise taxes to get social goods, as Ben said, such as infrastructure and addressing climate change. So where does the money come from? The middle class and the working class are already strapped, so you can't be raising money from them. You got to raise the money from the ultra-rich and from corporations who have been evading taxes. In order to do that, we need to remove the corporatism that my competitor participates in and therefore is unable, as the establishment Democratic Party is, to make progressive, to make transformative change.
So does that mean you wouldn't support an increase in the gas tax because everybody would have to pay it?
No. Actually, a gas tax is all very nice, but it should be much larger than that. That's a Band-Aid. It should be part, actually, of a carbon tax. But a carbon tax has to be done smartly. Otherwise, as I think was mentioned by Ben, it can affect the poor and the working class more, and it can be regressive. So how do you mitigate that? You mitigate it by having it progressive. A carbon tax almost became law in the state of Washington 2 years ago. It would have been the first state to actually enact a complete carbon tax. It was going to be revenue neutral, but there were thousands of dollars that was going to go back to middle class and working people in tax rebates. So a carbon tax will incentivize good behavior in our country so that we can address climate change, so we can save money and do the right thing. But it has to be done progressively and smartly. And there's absolutely no good reason to do that. We can't do that. We just need to get the corporate slant off the goal.
I'm glad you brought up a carbon tax because that's where I'm going next. I wanted to get all your points of view on this subject because you've all expressed concern about the issue of climate change, the need to address this issue in a comprehensive way in the very near future. So the question is, Would you support a carbon tax to discourage the continued use of carbon fuels and also to provide billions of dollars for renewable energy programs? Peter Welch?
Yes, I would. The carbon tax is really a price on carbon, and it's really important to understand that. Right now, there are enormous consequences with the use of carbon. It is causing incredible climate damage, and it will soon be irreversible. The cost of buying a gallon of gasoline or using carbon fuels does not include the cleanup cost, the environmental damage cost. So straightforward economics, you've got to include in the price the consequences of the use of that carbon-based energy economy. So that's the point of a carbon tax, and I do support it. I think it should be done at the national level, and it would also have to be done in a way where you would make certain that you got that money back in the form of rebates to low and moderate income people, because it would have to work at the end of the day as a means of reducing carbon as opposed to inflicting economic harm on hardworking people and small businesses. And it could be done properly designed.
So your idea would be to have a carbon tax and then people would pay at the pump. They would pay for heating oil, and then low and middle income Vermonters would have some kind of rebate system to reimburse them?
That's one of the designs that I think is appealing. One thing that has to happen is you can't impose the cost of the cleanup of climate change on the victims of climate change, and that's by and large working Americans. The oil companies have done fine under the status quo. Their profits have been record. In the last 10 years, they've had $1 trillion in profits. One of the things I've been fighting for in Congress is to take away the tax breaks that they get when they're a mature and incredibly profitable industry. So we've got it. This question of climate change, wildfires now in California, rising sea levels, the melting sea cap, the changing growing seasons. This is really, really serious, and I think Vermonters get it. So anything we can do, and it's got to be aggressive, and it's got to be ambitious, and it's got to be bold.
Dan Freilich, you were talking previously about your support for a carbon tax. It's needed to deal with climate change. How do you make it fair? How do you make it progressive so that low and middle income people don't bear the brunt of that taxation?
I think it's a great question, but I think one could broaden it and say, how does one get any good policy to be fair for middle class and working people and for the environment and for public goods? The problem is that all issues, I don't care if it's the environment, as we're discussing, if it's opioids or if it's healthcare, is always covered by a corporatist gravy that leads to everything being done in favor of corporations as opposed to the people and the planet and the environment. So in this case, it's very similar to the TPP. In theory, fair, not free trade, is a good thing for everybody, but it unfortunately has a corporatist flair to it, and that's why correctly Bernie opposed it. In this case, one has to get the corporations to have no more seats at the table than anyone else. And I think that, for example, taking money from the National Propane Gas Association, from American Gas Association, and from other similar type PACs is abysmal and prevents us from actually making progress here.
So do you think it's appropriate to use the tax policy as a way to discourage certain types of behavior?
Sure, although the carbon tax is just one part of it. The larger part, in order to fund transformative change for climate change, i.e. massive investment in renewables and mass transit, is that the investment shouldn't come just from the carbon tax. That's part of it. It's, in a way, penalties and incentives. The other part should be via very significant tax hikes on the ultra-rich and on corporations that have been evading paying their taxes for years. In order to do that, one has to remove the corporatism and the corruption that occurs as a consequence of that and precludes us from making progress.
Ben Mitchell, your thoughts about a carbon tax?
Well, I have to agree with Dan here that as long as the corporations are funding the campaigns and determining the debate, there's really very little hope. I mean, that's what the what are they called? The far right. Anyway, anytime you make a law, you're picking winners and losers. And if the people who are funding the campaigns and the people who are working making the laws are all having a conversation with the ultra-rich and the people who are benefiting off of the situation, that the winners are always going to be the corporations, whether it's the oil corporations or the telecommunications corporations. They're the winners in every debate. So yes, I favor a carbon tax. I favor putting solar panels on every publicly owned building in the United States, every school, every post office, every municipal building. That will reduce our taxes and create a huge source of publicly owned electricity to counteract the carbons. And then they'll also own carbon credits that they can trade on the carbon market.
And what about this idea being discussed, as Congressman Welch mentioned to us, some sort of rebate system for low and middle income people?
Well, as a low-income person, I almost never take advantage of rebates because it's always based on a tax system that I either don't understand or don't participate in. If you don't make enough money to you know, file your taxes and get your rebates, you're not going to get those rebates. 60% of Vermonters are living paycheck to paycheck. They don't have corporate lawyers to do their taxes and figure out what the rebates are. Having said that, The issue here is public investment needs to happen in the area of energy in order, because the free market capitalism is never, ever going to address climate change. They're the ones profiting from it. They're the ones benefiting from it. So they're just going to take a little bit of money and hire a bunch of politicians to make sure that they never have to address it. So even if we have a carbon tax, it's very likely that ExxonMobil will be exempt from it, or whoever the local friends are. And I'm saying that to say, We really do. I agree with Dan that before we can really address these issues, we need to take money out of politics and we need to elect people who have not received money from corporate interests.
Now, in this round, the candidates will have an opportunity to ask each other questions, and a brief follow-up question will also be allowed. Please make sure that your questions are no longer than 30 seconds. We're not looking for campaign speeches here. And your answers should be less than 60 seconds. We hope to get three rounds in. And candidates, you can direct your questions to either of the other two candidates. And I drew some names to determine the order. Dan Frylich, you came up first. Who gets your first question?
I'm going to ask Congressman Welch a question, please.
Go right ahead.
So I am running on a very simple platform. My platform is to bring honor and integrity back into politics to the best of my ability so that we get rid of corruption, we make better, more objective decisions without corporatism, and we actually can make a difference on core equity issues in America and maybe achieve equitable pursuit of happiness for all. My question is, considering both Ben and I announced publicly that we would withdraw from the election if you stop taking special interest money like many other forward-thinking leaders have done, why didn't you do so?
Well, first of all, you're making a suggestion that I'm corrupt. It's what you did when you ran against Senator Leahy 6 years ago. We in Vermont are pretty lucky. All of our members of the State House and Congress are really honest. Number two, I've abided by the campaign finance laws, and that includes filing my campaign finance reports. And I noticed that you haven't filed your report yet pre-primary. So you're lecturing me about someone who's taking legal contributions when you haven't followed the law with respect to the Federal Election Commission. And then three, every decision I make is based on what is in the best interest of Vermont and the country. And my record reflects that. I've taken on the big challenges with oil companies, with pharmaceutical companies, and with banks. And I will continue to be an advocate for strong advocacy for working Vermonters and working Americans.
So I just want to read from the Federal Election Commission. This is the money that Mr. Welch takes. I'm just giving you a few summaries. Pharma, Pfizer and Novo Nordisk. Pharma distribution companies, Cardinal Health and McKesson. Insurance, Cigna and Aflac. Doctors and hospitals, AMA, American Hospital Association, fossil fuel companies, National Propane Gas Association, American Gas Association, the military-industrial complex, Lockheed Martin and Honeywell, guns, NRA, agriculture, Agrimark, affordable housing, National Association of Realtors. This is no way to represent Vermont.
Dan, what you're not talking about is my record. I've taken on the banks. I've taken on pharma. I've taken on oil companies consistently and aggressively. And let me tell you what you're also not talking about, the new world of post-Citizens United. And when I ran in 06 in a very competitive race with Martha Rainville, both of us raised over $2 million from individuals and also from political action committees. And those include Labor, the Sierra Club, League of Conservation Voters, a lot of folks you left out. We were accountable for every dollar spent. And with that accountability, she and I made an agreement that we would not run a single negative ad. And that's the last time in the history of this country we've had a competitive congressional race without negative ads. We couldn't do that now in post-Citizens United. And I have a colleague out in Oregon. He was supportive of a transaction fee on stock transactions, which I was a co-sponsor of. And it made a billionaire on Wall Street angry. And he came out there because he could under Citizens United and spent millions of dollars trying to defeat him. So my campaign finance, all reported, all accountable, is based on making certain that I can have the opportunity for Vermonters to make the decision, not Wall Street billionaires.
Ben Mitchell, who gets your first question?
Oh, okay. I would like to ask a question also to the congressman. Three Vermont towns, Burlington, South Burlington, and Winooski, have voted to reject the F-35 first strike nuclear bomber from being based in our state for a host of reasons that include destructive impact on human communities, its damage to the environment, its outrageous cost, its chronic malfunctions, its inherent danger to Vermont life. The only beneficiary of the F-35, it's $400 billion already, is Lockheed Martin. And why are you siding with Lockheed Martin over the will of your constituents who voted in town meeting?
Well, first of all, Lockheed Martin has never, ever been in my office or talked to me about the F-35. Second, the issue on the F-35 was decided in an independent review, not with me being involved in where that would be placed. And the F-35, by the way, as a representative of a cost overrun, is appalling. And I voted against the funding of those Pentagon spending programs. I worked with Barney Frank and with Barbara Lee. But the Air Force needs planes. And the Air Guard here, which I'm very proud of, has a mission. And the Secretary of the Air Force has made it clear that if the F-35s don't come to Burlington, the Air Guard loses its mission. And there is a real challenge here because we support our Air Guard. And we support the incredible mixture of assets at that airport. But it's going to have an impact on the neighborhood. And I have been working with and confident that the Air Force is going to do everything it possibly can to take into concern the very valid concerns of people who live in the flyway.
So as a follow-up, the Adjutant General of the Vermont National Guard comes to the city council vote in full uniform with his cronies in full uniform and says, if you do not accept this plane, we're going to take away these 800 jobs. Now, I support the people of the Air National Guard. I believe that whatever plane they get, they're Vermonters. They'll figure out how to patch it back together and put it back on the road because they can make anything work. But the only beneficiary of this plane, so just lastly, I do not believe the Vermont, this is our only mission. They need a mission and they're not going to take it away. Plattsburgh, there's a lot of bases in New York. It's not a comparable thing. And to make that, I think that's threatening the jobs of the people of the Air National Guard in order to support an unconscionable position, frankly.
Ben, I got to say, I take issue with your characterization of the Guard. General Craig came. He represents the Guard. But you said the people who came with him are cronies. They're Vermonters. There are people that are important folks in the neighborhood. They're your colleagues and mine. And those are the people. By the way, Vermonters, we had more loss of life in Iraq and Afghanistan on a per capita basis than any state in the country. Our folks serve. And we've got a dilemma here because it does have an impact on the neighborhood. But let's not suggest ever that the men and women of the Guard are doing something that's pretextual. And the use of the word cronies I find very offensive.
Peter Welch, who gets your first question?
I'll ask Dr. Frelick a question. You've said that one of the four issues you're going to work on is climate change. And by the way, I was the author of the Waxman-Markey provisions on energy efficiency. And the goal there, we got that through the House, and it would have reduced carbon emissions by 80% by 2050. But what you did that's totally inconsistent is – you voted for the biggest climate denier I know, and that's Sarah Palin. her policy is not drill, baby, drill. It's burn, baby, burn. She would be drilling in the National Wildlife Refuge in Yellowstone. She'd be drilling in Lake Champlain if she could. So how do you square your advocacy for climate change action with your vote for a climate denier?
So I find that kind of question entertaining. So the Vermont Democratic Party, with your leadership and consensus, has tried to state that I'm not a bona fide Democrat. One complaint was that I haven't contributed enough or contributed to the Democratic Party. A second complaint was that I, in quotes, endorsed Paul Beaudry. I never endorsed Paul Beaudry, who was a Republican conservative from Bennington in 2010, I think. What I did is very politely I signed his petition. We met on the street, and he signed my petition. And in a spirit of just being nice to each other and bipartisanship, there's no endorsement. Then the party made a decision that I can't be a bona fide Democrat because once I voted for a Republican. I would do it differently again. You asked this question, or you had someone call in on CCTV, Channel 17. We were in the middle of a surge. Many troops were dying. I was watching them die as I was trying to care for them at Walter Reed. And I think it was so destructive at the time that Mr. Obama said the surge was not going to work. And I think it was going to embolden the enemy. And I think tactically I made a decision at the time to vote for McCain as a consequence of that feeling. In the big strategic retrospect, I certainly would do it again. And I have no problems acknowledging mistakes.
Well, you didn't answer my question about voting for the climate denier. And you just said you made a tactical decision. I respect John McCain, but I sure don't respect his warmongering approach. He was leader on getting us into Iraq. He wanted to stay constantly and escalate constantly in Afghanistan. He wanted troops on the ground in Syria. He wanted to bomb Iran. Bomb, bomb, bomb is what he said. And what you said about Obama, is that he was, quote, pandering to the left because he was raising questions about that war-making policy. And that is not tactical. That's a decision that, if you're in Congress, is about sending Vermonters to war. And I don't buy it.
With all due respect, Congressman, I don't think you know anything about public service. I've spent 23 years in the Navy. I've helped patch up probably thousands of American troops at this point. I don't think you know what you're talking about. What I am going to say is that one vote that I claim I would do differently is not something that strategically means anything about my commitment to climate change. Now, the definition of corruption that I found when I looked on a website is dishonest or fraudulent conduct by those in power, typically involving bribery. Now, I would say that what you partake in, as do many establishment Democrats, and Republicans do it much worse, I would call it corruption light. It is dishonest and disingenuous to claim or to portray yourself to be a progressive Democrat when most of your money comes from corporate PACs. And the bribery part, it is bribery. It's just legal because we've codified into law that it is okay for elected officials to have conflicts of interest. As a military officer and as a physician, I do not believe that it is professional or acceptable to be a public servant and to not try to minimize your conflicts of interest.
Second round of questions. Dan Freilich, who gets your second question?
I have a question to Mr. Welch. So my question is, if we Democrats have been espousing that wealth and income inequality is an unsustainable core issue and almost an existential threat to our democracy, why, as a congressman, do you spend so little time on the issue? I see nothing on your website about it. There's no argument to fight for return to fair progressive taxation, but you are willing to spend time on behest of corporations like that terrible opioid bill and EB-5 and telecommunications while your spouse is involved in ways that clearly create, if not actual conflicts of interest, clear perceptions of conflicts of interest.
Well, two things. I mean, one, obviously, I repudiate your suggestion, and I'm glad that person who's got pretty good progressive credentials, Bernie Sanders, has endorsed me in this campaign based on his knowledge of what I've done and my reputation in the House. Also, climate leader Bill McKibben has endorsed me. I'll tell you some of the things I've worked on. And I do know that income inequality is the worst. I've been opposed to that terrible tax bill that just got passed. But I have worked on getting money for Irene recovery. I've worked on energy efficiency, where we create good jobs for people as well as bring down carbon emissions. I worked on lowering the cost of swipe fees and did that with Senator Durbin against the enormous pressure of the banks. I've worked on funding for broadband in rural areas, and I've opposed these tax bills and voted for progressive taxation that you claim you're for. I've done that consistently with my votes for the Congressional Progressive Caucus, the Progressive Caucus bill. And by the way, on a major decision, I voted for Barack Obama and Joe Biden over John McCain and Sarah Palin.
We're going to have to pass on the follow-up questions in the interest of time. Ben Mitchell, who gets your second question?
Well, Peter, I'm sorry, but you're on the hot seat today as the incumbent. And so my question is about impeachment. I think one of the greatest issues facing the next Congress will be whether we can stop the destruction of American democracy by this reality TV star. You voted against even discussing impeachment last year when it came up. And then back in 2007, when Peter Peter Shumlin, sorry, when he got the Senate to vote in favor of impeachment, you lobbied the House of Representatives in Vermont to say none. Had the House of Representatives voted on a simple majority vote to have that discussion, you guys would have had to have that discussion on the floor of the Congress. This is about the unprovoked invasion of Iraq being lied to do, which created the global refugee crisis. So, you know, how can you say that you're going to stand up and vote and for impeachment and take this issue seriously, given your track record of trying to quash that debate to maintain power?
Well, first of all, you raise an important question on impeachment, and some of my colleagues have voted to proceed, all right? And the question for me, it's not about whether we have to have more accountability to the Trump administration. We certainly do. And I think some of the things he's done, taking kids away from their families, is absolutely inexcusable and outrageous, and he did it in our name. But we've got – this is a political process. There's no real definition except it's, quote, a high crime and misdemeanor. And I have always had the view – that in order for an ultimate outcome to have the credibility of the American people in a very, very divided country, it has to be done in a way that's above board, not just a political vote. And the Mueller investigation, I think, is the key to the kingdom here. He's got an extraordinary reputation for fairness, and I have been vigorous in my view that we have to protect the independence and the integrity of that investigation and let him follow the facts to where they may be and then act accordingly.
Peter Welch, who gets your second question?
I'll ask Ben. You know, we've got an opioid crisis, and have been having roundtables that are quite moving, eight different communities around Vermont, and enormous community activity with first responders, with our police, with our medical community, all trying to help folks. And they see that this is, in many ways, a mental health and medical issue. I noticed that you in the past have proposed that you favor legalizing heroin. And in all of the eight roundtables, that is not a suggestion I saw. I think it doesn't make sense, but maybe you could explain that.
Yeah, I'm glad to be able to speak about this because I know a lot of people who have many former students, many of my friends have struggled with opioid addiction. And this is not a criminal issue. This is a public health issue. This is people who are struggling for their lives. And so at the time that I said that, I was saying I was advocating for eliminating the black market by legalizing all recreational drugs in the name of changing it from a criminal issue to a public health issue. And I still stand behind that statement. I think it's the right thing to do, you know, with the for-profit prisons and all of that. But on a deeper level, this really raises a question. Who are the criminals here in the opiate epidemic? It's the pharmaceutical companies that doctored the evidence that created this situation. They knew that increasing the prescription and the evidence has been there the whole time. And I have to say that you are the one who's co-sponsored a bill to protect the pharmaceutical industries from prosecution. And that is, to me, significantly worse than just a suggestion that we shouldn't be locking up and beating up the junkies. You know, these are homeless
people have had a hard enough life. They don't need to be harassed by the police. They need help, okay? And not just Narcan, which is another handout to the pharmaceutical industry.
It's time now for some questions from our listeners, and we're going to turn it into a lightning round, which means your answers are going to be 10 or 15 seconds long in the interest of time. So let's start off. We got this from Edward, who is concerned about what will happen to the House Speaker if the Democrats take control of the House in November. Will it be Nancy Pelosi, and will you candidates support Nancy Pelosi? Edward has real concerns. He'd like to have a dynamic new person take over as the leader of the Democratic Party. Ben Mitchell, if you're elected, would you support Nancy Pelosi?
Instead of talking about that, I want to say that I advocate having the post office also take on banking responsibilities. And I'm doing this just because this is an important issue that we're not going to get to talk about. And I think that we need to stand against the corporate banks.
Dan Freilich?
No, I would not. Nancy Pelosi, I'm sure she's a very good congresswoman, but she's part of the problem. She's a corporatist. Most of her money comes from corporations. She has accepted that conflicts of interest is okay. And as a consequence, in my opinion, we Democrats lose widely.
Peter Walsh.
We're going to have change in the House. And what my approach on this is, we need to change the way we're doing business in the House to make it more effective to help the American people. We've got to take the power out of the Speaker's office, where decisions are consolidated and made, and they've got to go back to the committees. So whoever is a candidate, including Nancy Pelosi, is going to have to convince me that we're going to have major reform in the House. So I have no commitments to any candidate, and I'm going to be demanding from a candidate that we have House reform.
Another question we got, should marijuana be legalized at the federal level? Ben Mitchell?
Yes. I really take my hat off to Phil Scott for legalizing it here in Vermont, and I really take my hat off for not allowing the pharmaceutical corporations and the big business marijuana growers to come in and take it over. We need small businesses. We need small farms.
Peter Welch.
Well, at the federal level, the things we should do is make medical marijuana legal. Number two, we should defer to the states. If it is legal in Vermont, then there should be no federal prosecution. But passing legislation federally, while I'd be inclined to support it, I do think there's something to be said to let the states have the debate and make that decision locally, and eventually the federal government will come along.
Dan Freilich.
I think it absolutely should be legalized federally. Let's get the political oxygen that this utilizes out of the way. It will make things more consistent between state and federal legislation and federal law and make it a lot easier. Most notably, we'll be able to maybe address more core issues because we won't have this distraction.
We got a number of emails about federal gun legislation. Most of the people want to know if you would support a ban on semi-automatic assault weapons. Dan Freilich?
Yes, absolutely. My website details a very comprehensive, more or less 12-point gun control policy as a military officer and a physician. I know the consequences of guns. I'm not against guns per se. I've been trained in using guns, but we need reasonable but very aggressive gun control. That doesn't mean I wouldn't compromise with the Republicans.
Ben Mitchell.
Here again, my hat's off to Scott for passing this. And but frankly, all right, if we took the $400 billion that we've spent on the F-35, we could buy back every gun in the United States for $1,300 a piece. And I know even my most rabid gun supporter people, they would have to sell at least a few of them if they could get $1,300. We need to get more of the stray guns off the street as well.
Peter Welch?
I do. I do support gun safety legislation, including an assault weapons ban. I support getting rid of loopholes in universal background checks. I support getting rid of that bump stock loophole. So, yes, we need at the federal level significant gun safety legislation.
And finally, would you support lowering the voting age to 16? Ben Mitchell?
That sounds like a great idea. I think we need to do everything we can to increase voter turnout, to increase participation. We need to have a holiday on voting day, and we need to be automatically registered to vote just as being a citizen. It should be part of having a social security number, and efforts to suppress it need to stop.
Peter Welch?
I haven't decided on that. What I'm seeing at the federal level, it's a real challenge, is the voter suppression efforts of the Trump administration and some people in the states, like that Kris Kobach, who's now running for governor. And we've got to protect access to the ballot box. We've got to protect the integrity of it. And we've got to keep the Russians out of our elections.
Dan Freilich.
I think this is the only area where I'm going to agree with Peter Welch. Probably I would in principle support this. I'd want to see better evidence. I probably need to look and see what scientific data is out there on this. And it's possible we need some beta testing. In principle, it sounds fantastic, but I do defer the decision.
Well, it's time for closing statements from the three candidates. We're going to go in reverse order from that first question. Peter Welch, start us off.
Well, first of all, thank you, Bob, and thank you, VPR. I want to tell a little bit about how I got here and who I am. When I was in college, I was inspired by Martin Luther King. And on a summer day, I hitchhiked from Springfield, Mass., where I was living, out to Chicago, and worked in a community organization fighting housing discrimination. I ended up spending 2 years there. After I got out of law school, I went to law school at Berkeley in California. I had a chance to work on K Street in a corporate firm, on Wall Street in a corporate firm. I chose to work on Bridge Street in White River Junction as a public defender. And as a lawyer, the things I'm proudest of the most were the pro bono work that I did to help a farmer keep his house that was going to be taken away, to help the Cone Blanchard machine tool workers who lost their health care to get it back. And I love this job of serving in Congress because I get to help Vermonters. I get to stand up for them. And it's my hope that Vermonters will send me back, and I ask Vermonters for their continued support so that I can serve you for another 2 years. Thank you.
Ben Mitchell.
Well, as I said, I'm a democratic socialist, and the really radical part about that statement is democracy. And I think democracy is under attack from a variety of areas, and one of the key places where it's totally undermined is the way we finance our elections. Because you have taken money from corporate accounts, because they are funding your campaign, all of your decisions will be colored by that. And as a result of that, I'm going to endorse you, Dan Freilich, for this nomination, for this event. You haven't taken any money. I've watched you work your heart out around the state. We don't agree on everything, but I know that you understand the idea of opioids. You understand the issues there. You understand single-payer health care. You understand socialized medicine. And that I think we need someone to represent Vermont who does not represent the corporations but represents the actual people of Vermont. So you have my endorsement. I'm officially dropping out of the race as of this moment.
Dan Freilich.
Ben, I'm humbled and honored by that. Thank you so much. We've knocked on about 21,000 doors, and I often apologize to Vermonters for busting a bubble. We have a bubble that we progressive Democrats, including our delegation, are fighting for the middle class, for working people on the planet. But in fact, it's layered by corporatism, and as a consequence, it's corrupt. It's dishonest, it's disingenuous, and it's dishonorable. But more important than that, it causes horrific harm to many Americans who I see in an emergency room and in a hospital and when I have my reserve duty every day and every week and every month. If you vote for me, you will be voting for something different and exciting and wholesome. If you vote for Mr. Welch, you will be voting for a continuation of what has not worked, of a corrupt system, of a dishonorable way of representing. And most importantly, if you want an Ocasio-Cortez-like upset, you should vote for Freilich. If you want a Crowley-like victory, or you wished it was a Crowley victory, you should vote for Mr. Welch. Thank you so much for your time.
That's going to do it for our debate today. Many thanks to our guests, Peter Welch, Ben Mitchell, and also Dan Freilich. We appreciate you coming by.
Thank you.